everybody, and welcome to the Nutrition Network. And today we're very lucky to have Tracy Harrison all the way from Florida today in 15 degrees as we shiver here at this time of year, which is we're recording this in February. So Tracy, tell me, you know, why you're here. You know, obviously we're going to talk about the gut today, mm-hmm. and the sort of secrets that practitioners might not know, sort of digging down and solving some of the mysteries of the gut, which I'm really looking forward to personally. But tell us about you, Tracy, and why you're here speaking to us today.
Sure. And again, thank you for the opportunity, Kate. I really appreciate that. I am the founder and lead instructor at the School of Applied Functional Medicine, and we provide accredited continuing education for a huge diversity of healthcare practitioners from presently 75 different countries around the world, 22 different modalities. So a wonderful, rich mix. And it's part of my passion to just spread the abundance of more expansive, scientifically anchored, and practically applicable and valuable insight about getting at the roots of disease and helping people to address them so that the body naturally finds higher vitality. And certainly highly aligned with your mission here with regard to the importance of day-over-day lifestyle change and how essential it is for people to not only get well when they're sick, but to stay well. And so I'm very passionate about all of us around the world as a practitioner community, improving our skills, building a richer, warmer network of practitioners, because my goodness, healthcare transformation awaits all of us.
Certainly does, in a big way. Doesn't it? Yeah. Well, yes, because... you know, actually, a doctor just came out here. Who was it? No, it was you. It was Mark Hyman who mm-hmm. came out, wasn't it? Who's saying basically, I mean, not before time, but we won't get into that by saying that it was diet that, you know, played a huge part, obviously, in this whole recent pandemic. Obviously, underlying metabolic health is key. You know, we know that.
Yes, absolutely.
You know. So it's nice for that to have been said and to be slightly appreciatively received, because of course that's not been an easy task for people like us recently. So tell me, what about your journey? Why are you, you know, what are you an actual practitioner of nutrition, or what's your actual core modality?
Yes, it's a great question, because I did have, in the greater Boston area up in Massachusetts, I ran a multimodality practice for 14 years, I think, 13 years. And actually, I did step away from that a few years ago in order to focus fully on practitioner education. But certainly all of the ups and downs and ins and outs of having that fully loaded practice and working as a health coach myself, having a nutritionist and a nurse practitioner on staff. I'm a big fan of multimodality teamwork, whether it's in the clinic or through a referral network. But so much clinical experience and exposure to what's actually required for people to get well and stay well. And as you and I have joked in prior sessions, we can be scientifically quite astute, perfect, right? But the ability to practically apply that knowledge with all of the ins and outs of facilitating lifestyle change is a whole art into itself. Yeah.
A good communicator, because, you know, get those practitioners who, I remember one I studied with, he was so brainy. He knew all the answers to everything, but in effect, it's too much for somebody you're trying to communicate that to make them well. You know, it's all very well, but they don't want to know the detail. They just want to know the short version, really. It's like getting in a car and driving it. I mean, you don't really want to know about the engine. You just want to turn it on and off it goes, you know?
Well, and it's something that that our students really benefit from, that I'm really passionate about, is giving practitioners stories and simple everyday analogies that they can use for educating their patients, because we can have, I mean, we can have geek speak use all sorts of erudite language. But to your point, the patient doesn't know, want to know that. And even if they did, they won't, likely will not understand it. But it benefits people so much to have a aha experience. Oh my gosh, is that how it works? I had no idea. Because that education will galvanize them in maintaining lifestyle choices, because they're doing it now because they have an understanding, not just because they were told to do it and they're trying to be compliant. So I'm
that
passionate
only lasts
about
so long, doesn't it? You know,
it does. Sort of, yes.
Telling people, like, this is what you must do. I mean, unless there's the sort of understanding, people really don't stick to it. I mean, you know,
exactly.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah, and then it benefits no one really, does it? Because you know, exactly. You as a practitioner need to be successful with your patients or your clients or whatever mm-hmm. we're calling them these days. You know, we need to, because then, of course, that success breeds success because they go away and tell friends and all the rest of it. So, yeah. But yeah. Of course, the key to good health, as Confucius said, bliss begins in the bowel.
It
and
does.
I don't know if you really said that, because, but I'm going with that. So this begins in the bowel. So tell, you know, we concentrate a lot, actually, talking of which, on the bowel, but we rarely concentrate on this in the stomach area, in the stomach. Mm. You know, do we? We sort of kind of ignore it, apart from obviously HCL and whatever. So we're going to do a little bit of an exploration in the stomach today, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We are. Because I think, you know, it's funny. So to your point, my original love is chemistry, right? I'm a scientist by original training and had a long career in that before I shifted gears. And it can be so easy to get excited about the edge of technology, fascinating, geeky, sexy discoveries. And the gut, the published reference literature is so full of gut discoveries. And many times I find our attention turns to those and we leave sort of the lowly foundational concepts about health. And indeed, to your point, stomach acid is not very exciting. It's not very interesting biochemically. But there's a lot of dis-ease in human physiology that begins in the gut and specifically in the stomach. And I just wanted to, if I may, I'll just dive in and talk about some fundamentals. Because if there is a lifestyle choice that I find is most often overlooked in hearing practitioners talk about cases and working on intervention plans, chewing and also its involvement with what I would call eating hygiene is absolutely not sexy in any way. There is perhaps nothing more basic than something that we all do, perhaps beyond sleeping. But chewing is so essential, and teaching our clients that digestion begins in the mouth. I would actually lead with the fact that digestion begins in the mindset when we consider, especially here in the States, and I know it's unfortunately become rampant, but whether or not we're setting up an environment for eating. Are we eating rushing from meeting to meeting or driving in a car or while multitasking and doing something stressful? And the simple truth that when we are stressed, the body naturally deprioritizes everything related to nutrition. It impairs digestive secretions, whether it's hydrochloric acid or pancreatic enzymes or brush border enzymes. It impairs motility, nutrient absorption. And so the whole sort of cephalic, like pre-intake phase of digestion and whether or not the body is getting properly queued up. When we think about what affects whether or not what I eat is actually going to translate into optimal nutrition depends a lot on the environment in which I'm eating. And I'm emphasizing that not because it's novel, but because it's often neglected. We focus too much on telling people what to eat, but not necessarily how to eat or when to eat. And the whole idea of the simple practice of eating hygiene, of relaxing and sitting down and taking a few breaths, ideally not multitasking, or if you're multitasking, having it be something relaxing, but chewing food thoroughly, chewing food until it's largely liquid, so that it's really the only part of digestion, as we know, that's voluntary. Otherwise, everything below the mouth has to deal with what we did or did not do with regard to chewing. But research shows that the difference in the amount of, for example, stomach acid or pancreatic enzyme release is hugely affected by stress. I think we polled a group of practitioners once to ask them what they thought the percentage was, and most of them guessed somewhere around 10%. But research shows that it can be as much as 20, 30, 40% impairment in digestive secretions. And so just the whole notion of eating in a rushed or a stressed state has a huge impact on the downstream digestive experience. But I really want to talk a bit about the notion of stomach acid as being a bit of a digestive hero, especially in light of all of the things that the people we serve are likely to be doing that impairs digestive secretions, but also honoring the fact that hypochlorhydria, right, insufficient stomach acid, becomes progressively more prevalent simply as we age. And I think a long time ago, we used to believe that that had to do with maybe just a failure of the secretive cells in the lining of the intestine, you know, the parietal cells, this type of thing. But we actually are understanding that it likely has to do more to the progressive immunosuppression of age that causes more of a chronic brewing H. pylori bacterial overgrowth in the gut, and honoring the fact that H. pylori is these days an endemic part of our microbiome. I think a misstep that a lot of practitioners make is assuming that it's a bit of a novel pathogen that we're trying to wipe out fully, as opposed to thinking about it being a beneficial commensal bacteria. But the fact that H. pylori is present in the majority of our bodies by the time we are adults, but part of the impact of these microbes is impairing our stomach acid secretion so that they can thrive. And as we age, we're more likely to have a brewing overgrowth of H. pylori as we age. And so helping people to avoid other drivers for a reduction in stomach acid and this type of thing. The whole notion that downstream systemic disease begins in the gut or begins in the stomach. When we think about maldigestion of proteins, making because of the HCl is denaturing proteins and therefore less availability of amino acids. In the world of functional medicine, which is obviously our focus, the insufficiency of vitamin B12 or various minerals like zinc or iron or selenium, because we aren't denaturing those proteins, and is of course a wonderful reminder that all of your audience are going to be passionate about, that we are not what we eat, right? The old adage, we are what we consume, digest, absorb, convert to final forms, and get past the cell membrane. And that's a much higher hurdle. But in terms of drivers for, downstream effects, it's not just about nutrients. It's when we poorly denature proteins, they're more likely to be antigenic. And the role of low stomach acid in creating food allergies and food sensitivities, immune hypervigilance, the role of downstream poor hormonal signaling for enzymes and bile when stomach acid is insufficient. The fact that it has a big impact, gastric emptying is influenced by the pH of chyme as it exits the stomach, and that affects incretins that are released in the duodenum, and that affects insulin signaling. I think the whole gastric emptying, the relationship of that with insulin control, is a fascinating arena of research, which reminds me, by the way, like we chatted about, I am going to send some references.
Oh, fine. Yeah, that would be really helpful because I think people love to look those up. I was just thinking, curious about the allergy, allergy reference that you just mentioned. And obviously there may be plenty of other contributory causes, you know, that's probably not just one. But, especially in young people, do you think this has got the obviously the stomach has got something to do? I mean, obviously they're eating sometimes rubbish foods anyway. But do you think that's got anything to do with this sort of massive explosion in allergy in young, obviously there may be other causes, as we well know, but do you think this is contributory to allergy even in younger people?
I do. Allergy and asthma, immune hypervigilance. It's especially where children, and again, I appreciate that there's different cultures around the world, but especially in the US, children are more likely to, you know, not sit down at the table and have a relaxed meal with the family, but, you know, running around and eating at the same time and just trying to get calories in somehow. That's actually
even when you're sitting down and eating, I mean, some families, it can be really a big stress, you know, because, it's a chance for the parent, I was going to say the father, you know, normally to discipline the children, you know, about manners and sitting up straight and, you know, and actually, you know, it sort of can be a double-edged sword where people obviously hate to sit down.
Of course.
And eat with the family because it's another stress. So, yeah.
My childhood was a great example of that, right?
Yes. Where you have a flaming row in our family.
Exactly. Even if there's a desire to sit down, I think families can turn mealtime into something really fun where, you know, there's conversational games that happen. It's a positive place. It's where stories are told and recognition and celebration takes place. And,
absolutely. You know, it can have all those marvelous connotations, but it can also go the other way. Yeah. So so children, with children particularly, modern lifestyle might, you know, running around, the food they eat, the environment, the rushing, all of those things could also contribute to a potpourri of other reasons why allergy is taken off.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And then all sorts of issues downstream with regard to maldigested foods, providing excessive food fodder for the microbiome and contributing to overgrowths. We know that maldigestion often goes along with various types of dysbiosis in the microbiome and contributing to that, where our systems are really designed for the microbiome to just be getting debris, right? Residue from our diet. But maldigestion sets up all sorts of additional fermentation options for the microbiome, you know, including amino acids, right? Tyrosine and tryptophan not being so well absorbed because bacteria are creating putrefactive short chain fatty acids. And so interesting downstream physiology there for sure. But I think we're really entering an interesting period of research just in the past, I'd say 5 to 10 years alone, where we're understanding just how much of the gut is involved in insulin signaling and in the epidemic of insulin resistance in various stages of metabolic disease. I mean, even in some of the most popular classes of medications now are really trying to mimic the behavior of gut hormones that are present in driving insulin signaling. And it's a synergistic relationship, obviously, around gastric emptying and some of this hormonal signaling. But stress can play a huge role in interfering with that. But
so
I think,
yeah, part of life, but it's sort of like, so, you know, you were talking about simple strategies for, you know, people who are, you know, like chewing, a simple strategy in a way, but, you know, sort of the reducing stress around mealtimes, another simple strategy, well, apparently simple strategy, and stress reduction generally, you know, to create the right environment, because otherwise you get into supplementation, of course. You know, maybe too early.
Yes, let's talk about that, right? Because I do think undoubtedly your practitioners work with people as they're older, and it could be a real breakthrough. Say if someone is, you know, 78 years old and has various types of gut dysfunction or nutrient deficiencies, especially hallmark things like B12. It can be wonderful to help them understand that there is an age-related impairment there, and vitality as they continue to enjoy life could really be improved with some sort of supplemental boost for digestive function. And in minor cases, that might be something like bitter herbs, right, that are more stimulatory from a foundational perspective. And certainly hydrochloric betaine with pepsin in terms of actually supplementing with HCL is available, but even putting, you know, citrus juice, right? Lemon juice in water, or apple cider vinegar in water in order to create an acidic beverage to sip on during meals, helping people to avoid consuming huge amounts of liquid. And this is definitely much less of a concern in Europe, but in the US, there's a tough habit of not hydrating in between meals. And then people will come into a meal and consume, you know, 24 ounces of water or even more. And some of the restaurants in the States, the glasses they set down at a meal are hilarious. But not wanting to upset the pH balance in toward an alkaline direction. But there are some simple strategies for just boosting acidity away from, you know, a capsule, even in terms of the liquids we might sip on to clear our palate throughout a meal.
Well, obviously, bitter herbs is quite a good strategy. Mm-hmm. Which we forget to do even generally, you know, a bit nice, like Swedish bitters.
Yes. Swedish bitters or other gentian bases, but even things also like ginger, a ginger tea type of thing. There's a number of different options, but.
Because I trained like 25 years ago now, believe it or not, a quarter of a century ago, I started my nutrition training. So at the time we were sort of told, you know, with HCL, supplementation, that giving it for too long, I mean, as capsules, could kind of turn off the HCL. Is there any truth in that?
So certainly there is a feedback process in the gastric cavity. What I think is important is using a supplement, not at the very beginning of the meal, first because you worsen the likelihood of it being too much too fast. But thinking about maybe starting in the middle of the meal, and let's say a person takes two capsules, not taking them both at once, but taking in the middle, one in the middle of the meal, have several more bites, and then take a second one. But allowing the body to secrete what it will at the beginning of the meal, because obviously we're putting food in the stomach. We are creating a more alkaline environment. And so the progressive release of HCL is important. But I don't think there's evidence of any long-term impairment in the body's ability to synthesize it, because it's doing it steadily, not just during mealtimes. I mean, the base gastric pH is lower in between meals. I do think one thing we have to be attentive to, though, is the widespread use of acid suppressing medications. So proton pump inhibitors, H2 receptor blockers, that when people have been taking these drugs, even for, you know, several months, that there is an accommodating thinning of the protective mucosal lining in the gastric cavity. And so I think we have to be careful of that, because you take that environment, you put in too much HCL, people could develop some gastritis.
And also, doesn't it suppress the acid systemically as well?
Yes,
because obviously there are functions in the cell that you need acid for.
Yes, so it's why titrating down off of these drugs, we teach that it should take a minimum of 6 weeks. So I think often they're withdrawn very quickly and people get a rebound overproduction of HCL, to your point, which can make people feel like, my reflux is back, so I must need this drug. But ultimately helping people to get at the roots of their chronic acid reflux so they don't need the drug, because seldom is acid reflux caused by excessive production of HCL.
It's such a difficult one to explain, isn't it? Because of course, with, you know, the medical profession always diagnose it as, in effect, acid reflux, which would feel like it's almost like a glass or something, like a bath, or you know, having filled up like this, and then it's coming over the top, and it's almost impossible to make people see it another way, you know, actually that the problem is low acid, not high acid, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a big problem. And I imagine, like here, that people are popping these antacids like Smarties and not compensating for the lifestyle factors. But it's hard work, isn't it? You know, that's the point.
Absolutely. And I will share also from a root cause perspective, we find that most cases of chronic acid reflux are a combination of a fairly small basket of factors. And to your point, poor eating hygiene is one of them, right? In terms of causing dysmotility or the maldigestion, but low stomach acid is going to predispose someone to that because of the fermentation that can happen in the gut that blows open the lower esophageal sphincter. Insufficient magnesium to control that sphincter in the body. And also unacknowledged food sensitivities. And I would say gluten and dairy and citrus are probably some of the most common drivers of that from an acid reflux viewpoint. But nutrition professionals are so well positioned to teach people about what's actually at play in addressing the root causes so that people don't have to take the meds. In the U.S., there's also a certain measure of just crap food. The chemicals in food can be quite stimulatory to people. That alone can be a big driver. And instead of looking to improve the food so the symptom goes away, so often we're just popping the pill so we don't have to deal with the symptom.
Yeah, it's interesting about the food. But I mean, you know, I've been a lot to New York in the old days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in a healthy restaurant, you know, a place where you're going for healthy food, the portion sizes are massively whopping. I mean, the glasses, you talked about the glasses of water, but, you know, this is like enough for two people. And it's funny how we as humans...
Sometimes three.
sometimes three, absolutely. Just one plate. But it's probably frowned on to order just one plate and then share it between sort of 20 people, kind of thing. But so even in a healthy restaurant, that's the portion size is still a problem. Do you think there is... do you think it's the problems getting worse with people and their food, you know, like, like junk food? And I mean, imagine the Uber thing. I mean, I know that takeaways was always the thing in the US. I mean, in New York, it always seemed very magic that people could just order up a takeaway, you know. But obviously with Uber and all of these things, is it getting worse, or do you think there's a sort of turnaround with people whose health has suffered and then they're sort of looking for solutions as patients? I mean.
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually think in the time of the pandemic, what we've seen is a real bimodal response, because certainly not being able to go to restaurants is just but you could go through a drive-through, and you, maybe you couldn't go and sit down in a restaurant that might have more whole, high quality, nutrient dense foods. But again, you can go through the drive-through. And so people who don't cook much, I think a lot of that has gotten worse. On the other hand, people who can cook and do and know how to cook, I think it's been an opportunity over the past 2 years to eat at home more and to explore more and more working from home. So I have time to consider recipes and explore. And so in many ways, I think we've seen a widening of the population in terms of response, because people who maybe previously would have looked at a restaurant experience as something different have gotten quite beholden to the notion of, to your point, being able to quickly go out and get something cheap, which in the States is not going to mean anything good. It's going to mean a giant serving of some kind of highly refined starch, which to your point is probably 3 or 4 servings, but not nutrient dense foods for sure.
So, yeah. So, you know, and all eaten on the rush. So obviously not doing our stomach any good at all.
Yes. Yeah. One thing I want to mention that I think is also is a bigger deal now, given where we are in the cultural shifts from the pandemic, is the impact of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And the natural impact that they have on the protective mucosal lining of the gut, some more than others, right? Depending on what variety and brand people are using. But certainly a lot more people having tension headaches and taking these medications. So
is that just generally increased, or do you think it's pandemic induced with stress and other things, or just, yeah?
I think it's both, right? I think it's the natural tendency of our culture to be seeking quick fixes. I just think the incident of tension headache was already an issue. And now it's much broader people are more so now that things are opening back up a bit, for sure. But coming on the heels of spending more time inside, more time in front of screens, more time contemplating frightening, alarming items, sleeping not as well, all of these types of things that just lead to more generalized pain and achiness, and many more people taking these types of medications just in case, or in order to take the edge off of low-grade inflammation that could come from a dozen things in pandemic times. And this has an effect on the entire gut, including the stomach.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, in effect, actually, I have, you know, it's interesting as I don't know if this is everybody else's experience as a nutritional therapist, but I've never even taken a headache pill. I've never had a headache. In effect, the only reason I knew I had COVID in 2020, March the 6th, 2020, was I had a headache. Otherwise I wouldn't have known. You know, it's interesting with I have a sister-in-law literally who's just popping them the whole time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Yes. And that sort of idea of, you know, that easy fix, you know, so yeah, because, you know, we were talking about the gut or the stomach and saying, oh, the patients have to chew, then they shouldn't be stressed, and then they have to do, you know, and it's quite a lot of work that. So going backwards, that's a huge lifestyle shift, isn't it? So how do we, you know, and also to put the two and two together, because I think these, if you see what I mean, you know, because it seems such a simple thing to say, well, chew your food and your symptoms might get better. They're like, yeah, but what's the short version of that, you know, sort of thing. Well, because they've got to change a whole lot of other factors, like the way they pick up their kids, you know, they're rushing to do that, or they, you know, they're grabbing something, you know, it's a huge shift sometimes, isn't it?
It is. And this is where I think practitioners who have very engaged roles, right, like a nutrition therapist, have the opportunity to really work through that step by step. And to your point, not trying to layer it all in at once. You know, here's 12 seemingly simple but very hard to maintain things, but working them step by step, one at a time. You can definitely encourage people to go through different journaling exercises on how they feel after their meals. It's no surprise to us, but it shocks people to realize, wow, if I slow down and chew and make time for a meal, I'm not exhausted 2 hours later. I'm less likely to have, you know, belching and bloating and acid reflux and these kinds of things. I'm a big fan of experimental trials where people can get curious and interested in trying a certain activity for 3 days or five times in the next week and then make notes on it. So it doesn't feel like I'm going from today to permanently doing something better, but more like a game, more experimental. But going back to your earlier comment, I think these are excellent things to practice as a family. I used to have a workshop that I routinely offered to groups of moms, and we would talk about things such as practicing chewing as a family, and everybody puts a bite in their mouth and chews, right? And, you know, the goal is to be the last person to swallow, and it's fun and it's funny and you laugh and, but everyone, you know, keeps chewing and is looking around. But when we're approaching these things from play, we remember them later. We form an impression. I think any way in which we can stir up these ideas where it feels like an exploration, it feels like play, it feels like a game or fun, that works for 5-year-olds and 50-year-olds in terms of exploring a new idea. But I think it's essential, and certainly your community is well aware, not trying to do too much at once. I think it's one of the biggest mistakes in the world of functional medicine for us. The whole notion of recommending even 4, much less 14 lifestyle changes at once, is just a recipe for not being successful.
But also the supplementation is loading on loads of supplementation, you know, before you've had a chance to really get people to make these changes, you know, absolutely. Yeah. But of course, you know, you talked about H. pylori, but the gut as well has got a load of other. I mean, funny enough, I was just speaking to somebody yesterday about this who was saying that, you know, we think of H. pylori as being a pathogen, but you've just intimated that it's part of, in effect, the microbiome of the stomach. So mm-hmm. What else is in there? And what else is, because, you know, you don't think of it. It's like sort of bacteria living in a geyser in the middle of sort of some really snowy, you know, like Iceland or something. You don't really think of things living in there. And it's apparently teeming with bacteria. So,
well, to your point, I wouldn't say teeming, right? In the sense of the population density of, excuse me, of microbes in the gut, because we certainly have way fewer microbes in the stomach than we do elsewhere in the gut. But H. pylori is definitely, you know, commensal. There's some interesting research that's looked at the fact that having the immune system primed by the presence of H. pylori helps to enable the immune system in the gut to prevent long-term parasite or, you know, worm infection. And so, you know, we think about the, you know, billions and trillions density of microbes in the colon, you know, when the stomach gets way less, I mean, it's thousands, but it's not zero. And it is just like in the mouth, because that's also part of the gut, it's priming immune function. And it brings up for me, Kate, the awesome concept of hormesis, that the body is strengthened through a persistent low-grade challenge that the body is able to respond to, and persistent, not incessant, right? Just like we do a little bit of exercise most days or every other day, we build muscle, we are strengthened. We would not want to go from being completely non-fit to trying to climb the largest mountain. Cardiovascular event becomes much more likely because we're not fit for that challenge, but we build that through a persistent challenge that is that we can handle. And the presence of novel of pathogens in the gut, part of why we're able to handle that is because a highly diverse microbiome has been priming the immune system in the gut all the time otherwise. And H. pylori ebbs and flows in density, and that's part of what primes the immune system. So I think to your point, it's a mistake to think about, oh, H. pylori, I just want to wipe it out. I want it to go away. Well, it's quite contagious. Actually, you'll pick it up from somebody else all over again. But instead, using the impetus for thinking about why is this overgrowing, right? What is the actual reason why this is overgrowing? Am I too stressed? Am I not sleeping thoroughly? Do I not have enough vitamin A or zinc or other things that contribute to immune strength and having good pro and anti-inflammatory balance, right? What's the wake-up call?
Yeah, because actually, you know, when I was practicing, my big trick, you know, on something completely different was actually candida, was iodine, you know, iodine deficiency in overgrowth of any description. So you'd try and tackle people's candida and you wouldn't, well, in my experience, I don't know if anybody else has this, you'd never be able to do it if they were iodine deficient. It just wouldn't be able, because it would just come back again.
Yes.
So yeah, so iodine maybe, I don't know if it's relevant in this, but it's a really useful nutrient actually that we kind of forget about.
Yes, we do. And your point is wonderful, because it also brings up the notion of subclinical hypothyroid function, which I think is rampant in our practices because of the way in which we've typically, even medically, diagnosed that by using a insufficient lab markers. But the notion that thyroid function is something that happens intracellularly and the enzymes that control it are acting intracellularly, and that people's thyroid labs are not necessarily matching the state of what's happening across the body. And low-grade iodine, even insufficiency, contributing to inadequate thyroid hormone. And as we say, sluggish thyroid, sluggish anything, including digestive secretions, including GI motility, and we associate constipation with hypothyroid. But to your point, immune function in the gut, the motility in the gut, and the, yes, including HCL secretion. So I think looking for these, it makes sense that overgrowths of innate commensals. And to your point, candida is also a normal commensal part of the microbiome, right? We don't want it to overgrow, but it's also unrealistic to think about completely wiping it out on an ongoing basis. So the iodine connection is a wonderful one. That's great.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, you know, what about you're seeing for stomach health, in effect, the sort of trend for intermittent fasting and the difference that can make?
Yes, actually. So I think intermittent fasting is wonderful. It's certainly, your community well knows this, it's much better aligned with how humans have evolved, undoubtedly, right? Whether it is overnight fasting or occasional day-long fasting or seasonal, you know, reduction in food intake. And again, that becomes part of not only our metabolic flexibility and how we prevent having excess adipose tissue and metabolic dysregulation and this type of thing, but giving the gut a break from eating. Oh my goodness, this is a big deal. Because if we think about the wear and tear that's happening on this sort of gut playground, whether it's dealing with chemicals in our food and microbial warfare and all sorts of oxidative damage, we need to clear the decks often way more than we do. I mean, you probably, like me, you have clients who are eating until 10, 11 o'clock at night, and then they're up having, like, you know, their crazy first breakfast at like 6:30.
But there's a culture, isn't there? Even in TV programs, you notice it. I mean, I think more in American programs, you know, maybe I'm because I never watch television. So my television references are rather old, I'm afraid, like Frasier.
You know, yes, mine and yours both. No worries.
Yeah, it's like, well, left that and television in the rear view mirror. But, you know, it's interesting how it's so attached to, you know, I was watching a Frasier recently. And for those of you listening in, you're like, Frasier, what the hell is that? Don't worry about it. You haven't, I mean,
it was a good show.
I still love it. I still love it. Yeah, I recommend it. But he's an emotional eater, you know, and if he's got any kind of crisis, he goes straight for the food. And so a lot of people are, you know, and again, I think, you know, talking around this topic, we're really saying it's lifestyle, because it's not addressing emotional yes. triggers, and he's going straight to the fridge, stuffing his stomach all the time with food, you know, and almost like in a gobbling way. So emotions come into this as well, don't they? Because I think we say, I feel sick to my stomach, and all of these phrases, you know, which are phrases, which are emotional as well.
Yes. Well, sure. And brings us back to the fact that our oldest and most diverse nervous system is in the gut. And the vagus nerve is having a huge impact on downstream reflection in the gut of how the brain and the central nervous system are responding to our environment. But I think fasting, to whatever degree it's appropriate for a given individual, right, is a critical component of nutritional guidance so that people's gut gets a break. I do think it's essential. And even the difference, I mean, there's all sorts of strategies. I'm sure we could share many of them. But even when people tend to eat in the evening, you know, can we have herbal tea instead? But how do we back away from, I'm going to go tuck into a large bowl of ice cream or a bag of candy or a bag of crisps, these kinds of things.
Do you think that's treating, do you think that's sort of environmental, like environmental meaning, you know, when I was a kid, I don't know, you know, you look younger than me. But when I was a kid, which was basically in the 60s, you know, so quite a long time ago, that we just didn't have any capacity for treating at all, really. Yeah. I mean, we had sweets on a Saturday. That was really it. You couldn't buy anything. But now I'm just thinking that it's much more available environmentally. So people can just pick up some candy, pick up this, pick up that. So first of all, it's an environmental problem, maybe. The second one is acceptability, maybe, as well. So, you know, in other words, it's more acceptable to snack. It was never acceptable to eat between meals when I was growing up in the last century. And what else that contributes to it? I'm sorry, my brain went out the window then. I was thinking, oh, I don't know, but just sort of like it's an environmental cause. So it's so difficult for people, and also the emotional thing, isn't it? You know, you're rushing your life. Maybe, I mean, I suppose lots of people's lives are very full and spiritually fulfilled and all the rest of it, whoopee do, but you know, it's, you know, people doing really bullshit jobs, and, you know, and actually that's the only thing they've got is food. When you're trying to take this away or try to take it away, you know, it does feel like something fundamental, which is a huge pleasure has been whipped from under them. I don't know where I was going with that point, really.
Well, but let me address a couple of those, and it may trigger you, because I think it's an excellent topic with regard to, yes, cultural acceptance. But we have a lot of conveniences in modern life now that take away some primary arenas of satisfaction in people's lives. And then we end up looking for easy ways to get the satisfaction back. And so if we think about the number of stressors, and especially people spending more and more time online especially younger people, but on social media, and, you know, comparing yourself to all sorts of virtual definitions of success or beauty or family. There are so many reasons to feel inadequate. There are so many reasons to feel stressed. Certainly the pandemic, so many reasons to feel fearful, and people will absolutely eat for the serotonin and the dopamine hit in order to just self-regulate. So I feel like, the health coaching traditions teach about the concept of primary food, and that the things we most crave and need to nourish us are not the foods we chew. They're the foods that surround us. And so things like intimacy and affection and challenge and adventure and celebration, just the things that make us feel nurtured. And I really believe that so much of how our culture has evolved is taking a lot of that away from us. And we're going along with the crowd and doing these things, right? More and more families likely here in the States to not eat dinner at the dinner table, but to eat dinner at different times, in different rooms, in front of a TV. And there's a nurturing, you know, when do I tell you about what I did at work today or at school today that was awesome, and you celebrate with me and I feel seen and heard and embraced? When does that part happen? Or you high five, or you hug me, or you kiss me. When do we do that part? It's just interesting. You take that away, I think people are looking really for fixes.
Yeah. And also it's kind of like, otherwise you end up, I mean, I'm sure in some families, like almost like flat share, you know, where everybody's got different foods. Exactly. And I don't know, I think maybe, I mean, even with my daughter's 16, and, you know, she doesn't like the food we have, because, you know, like, although my food's all organic and blah, 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 she's like, oh, I don't like that. I don't like this. I don't like, and it's like, where did I get this? You know, and I don't think it's uncommon to me. I mean, she's better than some. We always sit down at the dinner table, for example. But you know, it's still, I think it's an environmental thing where, you know, at school they're fed crap, basically, you know, and if, you know, and it's indulged, and there's sweets at every checkout. There's, you know, it's sort of, I don't know, it's just such rubbish. Even in, I mean, especially in schools, you know, it's just rubbish. And then they get a sort of taste for it, you know. Yes. I remember when she was about three, and we didn't have any sugar in the house, just, and not because I'm massively, you know, like would never touch the stuff, but I just didn't have sugar in the house. And the first time she discovered chocolate cake, literally she had a face plant in this cake, you know, like this. She was three, you know. Why didn't you tell me about this fantastic drug you've been driving? She's never looked back since that moment.
Yes, anyway. Exactly. Totally. Yeah. And we know it does completely influence our taste buds. I mean, we teach that withdrawal from sugar, at not the physical part, but the what people expect their taste buds to respond to. That takes weeks at a minimum. Some people need 2+ months in order to begin to, you know, you taste a sweet potato with nothing on it and it tastes sweet to you. But if you're used to eating a lot of highly processed foods, that's not a transition that's going to happen in days. But I think setting client expectations is huge for that, so that people don't give up too quickly. but it also highlights why I'm a big fan of, actually, let me describe this real quickly because it's a great opportunity for a whole family. The new foods list, every time a child tries a new food, they get a sticker, a gold star, a check mark, something, you know, you can have a chart on the fridge, but getting out from under that the goal is to like it. There are too many things we try one time and we don't love it, so we don't go back to it. I don't know about you, but I certainly grew up in a family where, you know, my dad would say, your mother prepared this meal. If you're not hungry, you don't have to eat. But on no planet would someone jump up and make me a bowl of cereal or a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because I didn't want to eat the salad. The only food that would be offered was the meal that was prepared. And I was perfectly allowed to say, I'm not hungry, can I be excused? Or I'm not hungry and push my plate away and I might, you know, sit there and, you know, drink my milk or whatever as a kid. But because of that process, I can remember many vegetables that I didn't like as a kid, but after you try them 8 times, you're like, all right, it's not my favorite, but I'll eat it. And then now it's some of the things I adore the most as an adult.
Yeah, Brussels sprouts. I love Brussels sprouts.
Me too.
I'm passionate too about Brussels sprouts. Mm. Chopped up really fine with
absolutely
lovely.
Oh, that sounds great. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Very but nice. You can, kids and adults, you can have a chart and, you know, you have a good fun with this, right? The goal is to just have 2 bites and you have to chew it up and swallow it, but you don't have to love it. That counts as you tried it. You get a check.
But it's funny, you know, how our generation, in effect, well, people, you know, like, have ruined these children. What have we done to these kids? You know, is it us or is it something outside? Is it because in our, you know, when we were kids, it wasn't tough. I mean, I'm not saying it was tough, but, you know, it was tough in the sense that people were quite strict, you know, and, you know, made you do stuff. And did that kind of swing us the other way to indulge our kids, you know? I speak for myself here, you know.
Yeah. Well, and to your point, obviously everybody's different and environments are different. But I think in terms of thinking about trying our best to give a little person the skills and the awareness that they need to be successful, independent adults. And that involves challenges. It's not about making everything super easy or permissive or 100% on their terms, because the world won't accommodate that very well when they try to step from having a highly cloistered environment to something that is not going to change itself based on their preferences. There's a crevasse, right? But to your point, the skills that children are not given when they're younger, then of course they end up suffering, you know, as young adults. And the number of young people in their 20s in our practices who have type 2 diabetes, who have asthma, who have IBS, and they literally, they're learning possible lifestyle changes now. And they know it's so hard for them to even contemplate them because it feels foreign, because it wasn't an occasional norm, right? Growing up, like I was taught that microwave burritos are the definition of dinner. So now you're talking about something that feels totally foreign to me. But chronic disease is showing up earlier and earlier for a huge variety of reasons, but I can't tell you how many families I've worked with over the years who have great success with, you know, every meal we all play the new food game. And, you know, after you get 10 checks, you get some fun activity, some non-food reward, and it engenders the habit of trying new foods, whether you love them or not, toward the goal of broadening the palate. And you can gamify it. You can make it fun. I think it's so much about nutrition is gamifying things, because otherwise people have really strong visceral, like acceptance or rejection reactions that are pretty hard to transcend.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah, absolutely. And it has to be taught, you know, something that we accepted as quite, you know, part of a family was food, you know, and that nourishment, as you say. I mean, you know, it's really to do really at a very base instinctive human level, is food is just this incredibly important thing, because obviously without it, okay, we could last a month or however long we could last, but we'd be in trouble after that. So of course there's a fear, there's all sorts of emotional kind of drivers behind food and our choices in it. And you know, the lovely book, which, or lovely, it's called, you know, Robert Lustig's book, The Hacking of the American Mind, all about the addictive nature of modern food and all the rest of it. But, you know, bringing us back, because that's whipped past an hour. So
I was just going to say, we could clearly keep going.
Yeah, but so if we're sort of looking back at the, you know, we've sort of got some, you know, broad-based lifestyle strategies there. So, you know, just in closing, what would be your sort of top tips, your top three, maybe, you know, don't limit to three if you don't want to, but top three tips, you know, I mean, the first one might be the chewing.
Yes.
To,
that would definitely be at the top, for sure. I think the second thing is realizing that if we're going to help people with nutrition, we must help people with stress, that those cannot be separated. That, you know, stress, like we've been talking about, sets people up for microbial overgrowth. It sets people up for maldigestion. But it also sets people up for higher demands for certain nutrients, you know, things that are naturally more heavily utilized by our biochemistry during times of stress, you know, things like magnesium and B vitamins. And so thinking about stress as belonging as an essential pillar of nutritional therapy, I think is key in terms of helping people to get in front of it. Thinking about the impact of medications, and the stomach is of note to me because, at least in the States, it's the things that people are most likely to buy over the counter that are going to have an impact, whether it's an antihistamine, a painkiller, an acid suppressant. These are things that people don't necessarily have a prescription for. They may not even necessarily think about it as being a drug, but it has huge impact on the gut, and especially on upstream gut function. We have this perception culturally that they are benign, and they are not. It's insidious because they're so not benign. And yet our assumption is that they are benign. And so making sure as practitioners that we really do an inventory of those, and we really understand what is at play for people, I find that's often overlooked in clinical practice for that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But then the fourth one I'd add is just the notion of primary food. You know, it's even simple, fun things that people can do in their homes, like put a sign on the refrigerator that says, most of the time, what you're looking for is not in here. You know, what is it? What are you actually craving? What are you truly feeling? Are you feeling angry? Are you feeling frightened? Are you feeling stressed? Are you feeling bored? But encouraging our clients to start getting honest about what is it that you're actually feeling that we could get at the roots of, as opposed to just using food to numb it.
Yeah, no, very interesting, because actually, interestingly, we talked quite a lot around the lifestyle issues. And, you know, as functional medicine practitioners, sometimes we want to get onto the fancy footwork, you know, and you know what, sometimes the basics are really good enough. And for all the practitioners out there, it's really about, you know, looking to some of these really basic things that you might just have forgotten about and need kind of pulling out of your bottom drawer as a therapist to encourage patients or encourage your clients to relook at and rediscover. So that time went so quickly. So tell us again the references. We were going to look at the references. Why don't you send those to us so we can have those, so we've got them. But meanwhile, how do people get hold of you and, I mean, access your resources and all the rest of it?
So our website is schoolafm.com, School of Applied Functional Medicine. On the website, there's hundreds of clinical tips, by the way, on a rich diversity of topics. So a lot of resources that folks can access, and they can engage in a variety of informational sessions to learn more about the school or that type of thing. What we offer in terms of training is very much like a master's degree in functional medicine. We created it because it's a major gap in what's available in functional medicine training out there today. And so I encourage folks to check it out. It's lots of resources there on Facebook. Our page is Applied Functional Medicine. There are hundreds of videos there on specific topics. There's like 22 on various aspects of the gut. So many resources that folks can take advantage of. And I'm delighted to share.
Fantastic. So, and they can get hold of you through the site, obviously, you will be a returning guest with us. And, so we'll look forward to that. No, definitely. Thank you so much, Tracy. That's wonderful. Enjoy your day in Florida.
Indeed.
And so we'll talk really soon. That would be fun.
Indeed. Right. Thank you so much, Kate. I appreciate the opportunity.
Goodbye.